Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, shock in Boston's Jewish community following a shooting at a synagogue in Pittsburgh that killed 11 people.
We need to be together, and we're not going to stay in our houses. We're not going to be afraid to be Jewish. In fact, being Jewish gives us strength and a moral compass to support refugees, to support people in need, to support Muslims. We have to bond together, so that's how I see it.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions addressed the attacks while in Boston.
This was not just an attack on the Jewish faith. It was an attack on all people of faith. It was an attack on America's values.
Also today, we'll talk about the Red Sox win and an immigrant's journey trying to understand race in the U.S. That's all coming up next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. We're learning more today about the 11 people killed in that tragic shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh on Saturday. They ranged in age from 54 to 97. 8 were men, 3 were women. 2 of them, Cecil and David Rosenthal, ages 59 and 54, were brothers. Both lived in the Squirrel Hill neighborhood where the shooting took place. Another 2 victims, Bernice and Sylvan Simon, were a married couple in their 80s. Rose Malinger was the oldest victim. She was 97 years old. We have a link to all the names and remembrances up on our website, radioboston.org. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders spoke to reporters in the last hour, condemning the attack.
This atrocity was a chilling act of mass murder. It was an act of hatred. And above all, it was an act of evil. Anti-Semitism is a plague to humanity, and it is responsible for many of the worst horrors in human history. We all have a duty to confront anti-Semitism in all its forms and everywhere and anywhere it appears.
The suspect, 46-year-old Robert Bowers, was arrested on Saturday and brought to court today, where he waived the reading of charges against him and was assigned a public defender. We're going to spend some time today on this story. And listeners, we want to hear from you on this as well. How are you reacting? Where do you turn for hope in moments like these? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can tweet us at Radio Boston. In a few minutes, we'll speak with a scholar of Jewish studies. But first, David Shribman, a longtime Bostonian, joins us from the offices of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, where he is the executive editor. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
First, you know, we want to express our condolences to people in Pittsburgh. We know this is a dark, difficult moment. This is your community. You live only 3 blocks from Tree of Life. Can you give us a sense of how you and people around you are wrestling with this violence today?
Well, people here now, Maria, are in the kind of situation you're in after a shocking death, and that you're pushing through with lots of things to do. In our case, we perform our mourning by doing our service through work. And so many others have the same situation. But what I worry about is when the work ends and the urgency subsides, and it really hits us that 11 of our neighbors have perished senselessly, horrifically, and violently, how we're all going to react. And I worry about my own family, and I worry about our community, my neighbors, and I, above all, worry about my colleagues here at the Post-Gazette.
Mm-hmm. There's no doubt this has surfaced some collective trauma. You know, in the Boston,
that's for sure.
In the Boston Globe today, You quoted Steven Weisman, who wrote the most recent history of Judaism in America, and said that the fabric of American Judaism is woven into Squirrel Hill. Tell us more about what you call one of the most vital centers of Jewish identity since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
Well, first of all, unlike Boston and other places in the country, Jewish life did not migrate to the shiny, fresh suburbs, some of which, including the one I grew up in, Swampscott. Jewish life did not migrate to Lexington and Wellesley and Marblehead. It stayed, in our case, in Squirrel Hill, which is a neighborhood a little bit like Brookline, though substantially smaller and within the city limits of Pittsburgh. The county executive lives a block or two from Tree of Life and three or four blocks from me. Mike Tomlin, the coach of the Steelers, lives two blocks from Tree of Life. Mm. Most poignantly, Mr. Rogers grew up right there and lived right there. Mm-hmm. Well, and so, but there's more. If you don't mind, I'll go on. Pittsburgh is really one of the founding places, if not the founding place, of Reform Judaism. It's where the Pittsburgh Platform was written in the 19th century. It's where the great debates about music and organs in Jewish ceremonies began. It's the site of where William Howard Taft gave a remarkable speech at Road of Shalom, which is right around the corner from, well, around two corners maybe, from Tree of Life. It is one of the centers of Jewish life, much like Blue Hill Avenue in Boston might have been two generations ago.
Well, you write about the irony that what some people are calling the most deadly attack on Jewish Americans in modern history happened in what you consider the least anti-Semitic city in the country. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, sure. I mean, I've lived in lots of places. I've lived in Boston and Washington and Buffalo and here and in New Hampshire. And, I've loved all those places. I have great affection for them all. But this is the only place where I've seen that it is very comfortable and easy to be Jewish for Jews and for Catholics and Protestants and Muslims and others who are very accepting, not only accepting, of welcoming. It's unremarkable that somebody is Jewish in this community. It's totally unremarkable to see people walking down the street, dressed in the garb of the Orthodox and the very observant. It's completely unremarkable for the rabbi and the bishop to go together on a single trip to both Jerusalem and to Rome. And in my own case, I have a Catholic wife. I'm Jewish. Mm. We go together, my wife, Catholic wife, and her Jewish husband, and I, and the rabbi, to Midnight Mass, where the bishop, in his recessional, will stop and give us all a hug. Mm. That doesn't happen everywhere.
Well, I do want to hear from Rabbi Jeffrey Myers of Tree of Life Synagogue talking about the tragedy today.
We are a Tree of Life. You can cut off some branches from our tree, but Tree of Life has been in Pittsburgh for 154 years. We're not going anywhere. I will not let hate close down my building.
Hmm. I know so many of us are still asking this, David, but I wonder if you can share your thoughts. Do you see this violence as a reflection of hateful political rhetoric that's built up, or has it been stoked by it or instigated by it or both?
You know, I don't know whether it is a reflection of or a cause of. I do know that they exist in a coexistence. I do know that this is at base a political question. And here's how I'm looking at this right now. In a city that's grieving and that's hurt, and I'm looking out across the Monongahela, Ohio, and Allegheny Rivers and all the flags that have mast. This is next week we have elections, and that's a time for politics. This week we have funerals, and that's a time for remembrance, for regret, for memories, and to bury our dead.
Well, David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, joins us live from Pittsburgh. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
The thanks go to you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And just a reminder to our listeners, you can find a link to the names of the victims and what we know about them on our website, radioboston.org. Well, the shock and grief following the shooting in Pittsburgh have reverberated across the nation, including here in Boston. Hundreds of people gathered on the Boston Common yesterday for a vigil to mourn the 11 lives lost. Among them was Boston University student Ariel Stein, who's from Pittsburgh and attends the Tree of Life Synagogue. Here she is speaking at the vigil.
A year ago, I traveled to Auschwitz with some students from Boston University. I learned all about the struggles of the Holocaust, about anti-Semitism, and never would I think that my community would be the face of such an act. But it is up to all of us to love each other, to want to love one another, and to stand up for the other in society.
To hear more about how the local community is reacting, and to put this tragedy into the larger context of the growing anti-Semitism that we're seeing across the country and intolerance, we turn to Susanna Heschel. She's a professor of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, and she joins me in the studio. Hello, Susanna.
Hello.
Thanks so much for joining us. This is obviously a very emotional moment. We thank you for your time. And I know you're struggling, as are so many people. What's racing through your head at this time?
I feel as though this act has changed our experience of being Jewish in the United States entirely. As a professor of modern Jewish history, I have to say that I will not teach modern Jewish history in the same way any longer. We had thought it was different in this country, and we're discovering that we hadn't realized this undertone, this massive, actually, undertone in this country of neo-Nazis, of white nationalism, and so forth, that they would come to the fore and attack us, that there would be essentially a pogrom in America.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, experts say that the conspiracy theories, the hateful rhetoric surrounding anti-Semitism, you know, they're now being circulated by establishment sources, right? By, in some cases, some say dog whistles by government sources, giving them sort of a false sheen of legitimacy. What do you think about that?
I think that's very true. I've heard a lot of people debate whether President Trump has actually tried to arouse white nationalists and anti-Semites and racists in this country. But the issue to me isn't what his intention may or may not be. We don't know that. I don't know if he knows that even. That's irrelevant. The point is that there are people out there, these so-called white nationalists, who hate Jews, who hate black people, who hate Muslims, and so forth. And they're hearing a message loud and clear from President Trump. The point is, there is responsibility that each human being has to take for the impact of our words, how they are heard, what the resonance is, what are the effects of this? And this has to stop.
Mm-hmm. So I know that you have relatives who belong to the synagogue. I can't imagine learning of the news and wondering about your relatives. What has been the last, what have the last couple of days been like for you?
The last couple of days have been days of shock and horror and despair and terrible, terrible depression. It is Tree of Life, but it's also what this represents. Antisemitism has existed for 2,000 years, and we never thought that it would be called up in this way. That it exists as a rhetoric, as a passion for some people, we thought we could tamp it down. We thought that the United States provided a democratic society, a liberal society of tolerance. And this is what's been called into question now.
Mm-hmm. The Anti-Defamation League has cited a 57% rise in anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. since 2017, including bomb threats, assaults, vandalism, hateful speech. You know, this is shocking, but at the same time, not surprising, especially considered what's happened in Charlottesville and churches in Charleston and Sutherland Springs in recent years. I want to listen to, again, Rabbi Jeffrey Myers of Tree of Life Synagogue talking about the tragedy today.
I never thought this could happen in my synagogue, ever. I just never thought it could reach this level that someone would take into their own hands and make a decision that they needed to murder Jews.
What do you make of the rise of white supremacy and neo-Nazism emerging in the country, Susanna?
This is terribly frightening. It's a terribly frightening time for all Jews, but I think it's a frightening time for all people. You know, when the election took place of President Trump, people said, now you know what it's like to live as a black person in the United States, how it is to live with this, with fear, and with the kind of rhetoric that is so ugly, frightening rhetoric. So, yes, when this happened, of course, what was on my mind was Charleston and the murder there in that black church and all the many black churches that have been burned down by arson attacks throughout this country. I thought also of Bishop Romero murdered in El Salvador. The idea of killing people at worship is especially horrifying because we have a sense that we all want to live lives of dignity, live in a civilized world. And if there's one moment when we're excused from anger, from hatred, one moment when we can be vulnerable, mm-hmm. it's when we are at prayer. Mm-hmm. Prayer is that place of refuge in which we have our full humanity. Mm. So the attack is an attack on what it is to be a human being.
Mm. I want to go back to this idea that you were talking about earlier about the difference in impact versus intentions, right? And
yes.
that it doesn't matter, you say, what the president intends to say, but what matters is the impact. Now, we just heard at the top of this hour a strong statement from the White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, condemning this act. The president also spoke out strongly against anti-Semitism earlier. We should remember his daughter is married to a Jewish man. Do you feel that the White House has responded appropriately?
To issue a statement is a very easy thing to do. It's like sending a birthday card to an acquaintance or a friend. The issue is the friendship all year long, not just the birthday card. So fine, the White House issued a statement condemning anti-Semitism. Good for them. That's not the point. The point is assuming responsibility. And not just 100% responsibility, but even going beyond the minimum requirement and stopping this kind of language. And we've heard it over and over again, the vulgarity issued from this man, this president. Now, let me also, if I may, make another point, which is, there is no quid pro quo when it comes to anti-Semitism. We don't excuse one statement because we have something else under the table that's handed to us. In other words, I heard, in fact, on the radio this morning, a man calling in and saying, well, President Trump recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, therefore he can't be anti-Semitic. And his daughter converted to Judaism and married a Jew, his grandchildren Jewish, so forth. That's not an excuse for anything. There is no quid pro quo. That is, I don't care if he moved the embassy to Jerusalem or didn't move it. What I care about is the Jews shouldn't be murdered.
You know, you teach Jewish studies at Dartmouth College. How will this change the way you teach? How does this change the narrative of being Jewish in America?
This changes the narrative entirely. I must tell you that when I teach modern Jewish history and I talk about the Dreyfus Affair in France and the pogroms in Russia and I talk about the rise of Nazism and the Holocaust, and then I come to the United States and it's a different story. The United States, the place of refuge, United States, where nothing like this could happen.
Right.
The difference, the American difference, although I've also taught an article by my colleague Tony Michaels in which he argues that, in fact, it's not so different. But I have to say he's right. It's not so different. I can't talk about it as different any longer. Antisemitism isn't kept from our shores. We are not protected because we have oceans around us in the United States. That's what's frightening, and that will change. And we have to understand that antisemitism is not a product of a given country or a particular political movement. It can be taken up by any political movement, left wing, right wing, it doesn't matter, and used with such gruesome brutality. That's what's shocking.
Mm.
How available it is, so easily available.
Mm-hmm. Professor of Holocaust History at Emory University, Deborah Lipstadt, likened anti-Semitism to a herpes infection that lies dormant and then reemerges at times of stress. Does that resonate for you?
Yes, it does. I've thought about it as termites. If you live in a house, you don't even know you have termites. And then you lift a, you open a door, you lift a piece of wood in your basement, and there they are. Yes, it's a kind of infection that can undermine the foundation of a society, and that's what's important.
Okay. Susanna Herschel, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Also today, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was in Boston talking about the future of religious liberty, an event sponsored by the Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks was there. And Anthony, I gather the Attorney General addressed the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue over the weekend. Tell us what he said.
Yes, he did. So Sessions was here to talk about efforts by the Trump administration to bring and win court cases in support of religious freedom, as they say. And he said, given what happened over the weekend, this couldn't come at a more important time. Here's a bit of what he said.
We're still reeling today from the murderous rampage in Pittsburgh that took the life of 11 congregants targeted because of their faith, worshiping faithfully in their own synagogue. This was not just an attack on the Jewish faith. It was an attack on all people of faith.
Sessions called this an attack on America's values and said it cannot and will not be tolerated. So he more or less reiterated what the president said on Saturday when President Trump called the attack pure evil.
So Anthony, Sessions' appearance was scheduled before the attack to talk about the future of religious freedom. And I understand he was confronted by some religious leaders here in Boston.
Yeah, and it was pretty dramatic. So just as Sessions was beginning his remarks, Will Green, a Methodist minister from Andover who was in the audience, stood up and confronted him, reciting and then referring to verses from the Bible. Here's a bit of that confrontation.
I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me.
Thank you for your comments. And,
and you did not visit me. Brother Jeff, as a fellow United Methodist, I call upon you to repent, to care for those in need.
Well, thank you for those remarks and attack, but I will just tell you we do our best every day to fulfill my responsibility to enforce the laws of the United States.
Now, as police escorted Minister Green out of the room, another minister, a Baptist minister, Daryl Hamilton, stood up and continued the protest. You could hear people in the audience there yelling to him, go home. He, too, was escorted out by the police. So it was an eventful morning for Mr. Sessions in Boston. But after that disruption, he was able to deliver his remarks.
So give us a sense of what he had to say.
So Sessions was here to talk about what's really become a conservative rallying cry. And the way the Trump administration phrases this is a commitment to religious freedom. He talked about the Department of Justice's Religious Freedom Task Force, which Sessions established as part of an effort by the Trump administration to identify instances where religious freedom is under assault in their view. And here's a bit of what Sessions said.
We've witnessed the ordeal still ongoing faced by the Colorado baker who simply doesn't want the government to force him to create art that offends his religious beliefs. Why don't they just leave him alone?
So this is a key example of what Sessions talked about today. In that case, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had ruled against the baker, saying he had discriminated against the gay couple. But the baker argued that it violated his religious rights to be forced to create that cake for the gay couple. And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, which sided with the bakers. And Sessions says this is the kind of case that his Department of Justice is committed to successfully prosecute.
Hmm. Now, the Alliance Defending Freedom was also a big part of this event. Give us some context. Who is this group?
Right. So Sessions was introduced by Jordan Lawrence of the Alliance Defending Freedom. Now, this is a conservative Christian nonprofit group with the stated goal of advocating, training, and funding on the issues of religious freedom, sanctity of life and marriage and family. It's committed to the idea of religious liberty. It's pro-Trump in a big way, but its views are also controversial. The Southern Poverty Law Center, for example, has designated it as a hate group because, among other things, it has supported efforts to recriminalize homosexuality. That said, Sessions made the point that this cause, conservative defense of religious freedom, is gaining traction. He established a so-called Religious Liberty Task Force in the DOJ, and he said neutral umpiring in the courts is ascendant, while what he called liberal activism and ideology are on the defensive.
It's a stunning reversal. And so thanks to the president, President Trump, They're two more Federalist Society members of the United States Supreme Court.
And Maria, as you might expect, that statement earned a round of applause from the members of the Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society here in Boston.
All right, that's WBUR's senior political reporter, Anthony Brooks. Thanks so much, Anthony.
My pleasure.
All right, stay with us. Coming up, for the fourth time since 2004, the Red Sox are World Series champions. I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia.
Here comes a 1-2 pitch. Red Sox win the World Series!
That's the cue to get the duck boats ready. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh announced earlier today that the city will hold a championship parade for the Red Sox on Wednesday morning, starting at 11. Mayor Walsh also thanked fans for celebrating responsibly last night and pointed that in all the post-game euphoria, there was only one arrest. He encouraged similar behavior at Wednesday's parade.
Boston has certainly set a new tone around celebrations, and maybe it's because we have a lot of them, or maybe it's just because the way that we conduct ourselves. So again, I want to thank you all. We are a city of champions, so let's celebrate like champions.
The 2018 World Series title is the fourth Red Sox championship since 2004 and the 11th championship for Boston since 2001. For more, we turn now to Boston Globe sports editor Matt Pepin. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Maria.
Of course. And also here with us, as he has been throughout this Red Sox run, is Radio Boston's own Chris Sitterick. Hi, Chris.
How's it going?
Good. And I need to paint the picture for our listeners. Chris came to work today in professional attire with his button-up shirt, but over it, you're wearing a Red Sox jersey.
You got to wear the colors, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So what a season this Red Sox team had. 108 wins in the regular season. The most wins ever by a Red Sox team, and now they're the World Series champs. I mean, how good is this team?
They're pretty good, huh, Matt?
They're excellent. I mean, it's the best Red Sox team ever.
Yeah, I think you got to put it into context and talk about the teams that the Red Sox went through to get to this title. You're talking about a 100-win Yankees team. You're talking about a 3-win defending champion Houston Astros. You're talking about a back-to-back World Series appearance Dodgers. Mm-hmm. Maybe the toughest slate of playoff opponents that we've seen on the way to a title. They get a ton of credit for that. They lost one game to Houston and then go on to win four straight to finish that series. And then you've got the game three on Friday, 18 innings to bounce back after that and win game four just says so much about their ability to overcome adversity.
Yeah, so it was a wild weekend, right? That started on Friday night with an 18-inning game three. Can you give us some perspective on that marathon game and how the Sox were able to basically bounce back after losing such a heartbreaker?
I'm going to let Matt start with that one because I can't imagine working in print journalism trying to cover a game that ends at 3:30. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, it was one of the most memorable nights of my career, without question. And it was really a challenge. You plan for the outer extremities of most games, which in the World Series you dictate about 4 hours for a game. And so for this to go 7 hours and 20 minutes created all kinds of issues. You know, from having to keep people here so late because we ultimately wanted to at least get some newspapers on the streets with the final score and a couple of extra stories. We wanted to have our website updated for those who didn't go stay up all night. So it meant a lot of people staying up late and working until they were pretty bleary-eyed. But, it's a committed group, so we just fought through. I think that the thing that made it so, I won't say easy to do, but certainly entertaining and interesting, was that the game was so compelling. It had so many plot twists that, you know, it was like they always say, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. I don't know that you could have written a script like that, you know, on your greatest day in Hollywood.
Yeah, it was unprecedented. You mentioned 7 hours and 20 minutes long. That's longer than the entire 1939 World Series. Is that one game. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And special shout out to Nathan Eovaldi. Threw 97 pitches in relief in that game. That's a World Series record for a reliever. It's a guy who's coming out of two Tommy John surgeries on his arm. Incredible for him to put that much work in for this team.
Right. So both of you have basically already agreed that this is the best Red Sox team we've ever seen, right?
I would take a little bit of a bone of contention there on that.
Okay.
They're up there. I think that they're up there with the 04 Sox. Just if you look at the getting the monkey off your back aspect, without that 04 team, who knows what happens to the Red Sox franchise. Maybe top to bottom, this is a deeper team. But if you're talking about Pedro, Curt Schilling on the mound, you're talking about Manny Ramirez and David Ortiz as maybe the greatest 1-2 hitting combo of all time. I think it's close between this team and the 04 team.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the individual players, though, and the individual efforts. So Steve Pearce was the World Series MVP. He's not exactly a household name. What can you tell us about his performance and how he was able to be basically such a difference maker?
Oh, I totally had him pegged as the MVP. How about you, Matt?
No, not at all. No, he's but you know, it seems like every year in the World Series, there's always this player who rises to the occasion. You know, it's always you know, the stars are what they are, and they do what they do. But you know, part of being on a team is having the right people in place, and I think that's what happens. You know, we're about to publish a story today that you know, talks about all the things behind the scenes with this team and how they developed the kind of chemistry that made them so committed to each other and so, you know, relentless in the pursuit of their goal. And I think that, you know, a lot of times when you take a journeyman like Steve Pearce and you put him into that kind of environment, you know, the connection is made and it lights a fire. There's something to be said for, you know, being in a good work environment. Being in a good work environment leads to productivity, and I think that's what we saw over the course of the playoffs, where he was a tough out at the plate and certainly a reliable fielder who, you know, who also had a lot of great plays in the field as well. Some of his stretches at first base, I think, were, you know, flew way under the radar when compared to his accomplishments at the plate.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. He went 4-for-12 with 8 RBI for the World Series. And actually the first World Series MVP to play 50 games or less for his team. He was traded for in late June. And it was kind of a minor trade. Nobody talked much about it. He was brought in to hit left-handed pitching, which the Red Sox had been terrible at to start the year. And boy, did he deliver on that front.
Yeah, definitely. He was, you know, not much was made at the trade deadline of Dave Dombrowski's moves, but the players he did bring in ended up having a very significant impact. Steve Pearce one and Nathan Eovaldi the other, for sure.
So this was Alex Cora's first season as manager for the Red Sox. How much credit do you give him for this team's success?
Oh, the guy with the golden touch? Honestly, Matt, I don't know about you. I've never seen a manager be able to make so many correct decisions. It seemed like everything he did, I'd be screaming for 1 second and say, oh, nope, you're right, whatever you want. You got it, buddy.
I loved it during the series when he was making correct decision after correct decision, and everybody was either tweeting or expressing in some way. Man, they would love to have him go pick the numbers for the Mega Millions, because that's when the Mega Millions jackpot was over $1 billion. So I think that perception of him was widespread. But, you know, always I think there's something behind making those decisions, making the correct decisions. And he's a guy who really combines, you know, the best of modern baseball, which is to use analytics and all of the advanced metrics that we have to measure players' skills and abilities, with like the real old school baseball intuition. And I think finding that happy medium is something that Alex Cora does really well. You know, time and again, the players expressed how much they enjoyed playing for him. And that's not just because he informs them with, you know, when you face this pitcher, he's probably going to throw you a fastball first time out. It's because he trusts them to get the job done. And he explains the decisions with, you know, with metrics, but also with the right amount of, you know, sort of one-on-one attention that I think inspires confidence.
Yeah, his agent Scott Boras calls it correlytics, which is, I think, a pretty great term. One thing I think that matters to players is accountability, and he's clearly a manager that believes in accountability. After game four, he was taking some criticism for not pulling the starter Eduardo Rodriguez in the sixth inning. Rodriguez ends up giving up a three-run homer and put the Sox down 4-0. It looked troublesome at that point, but he stepped up and said, nope, that's my fault.
We felt the matchup was good for us, but, you know, that matchup is good for us when Eddie's fresh. And, you know, he's able to get that fastball up. I had Barnsley ready, and I was actually kicking myself for a few innings before the comeback.
So I think that goes a long way. He could have said we didn't execute on the pitch. Instead, he says that's on me.
All right. So you know I'm the arts and culture editor here at WBUR, so I have to ask a question this way. So our critic at large at Siegel wrote a piece today that says, if Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice celebrates the question of mercy, then Cora's Red Sox celebrate the question of loyalty. Basically, he's saying Cora really stood up to talk radio pundits, to everyday fans who basically questioned his methods. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I wish I could quote some Shakespeare back for you, but instead I'm just going to say I think that for his first season he showed he has a real ability to both look at matchups, look at the numbers, which is such a big part of baseball in this modern era, but also to know his players, to know how to communicate to them and how to put them in the best spots to succeed.
So on the other side, Dave Roberts, the Dodgers manager, has been taking a lot of heat for some of his decisions in this series. Do you think he deserves the blame for the Dodgers loss?
I can't criticize Dave Rogers because of 2004, the steal. So, Matt, take this one.
Yeah, I'm reluctant to criticize Dave as well, just because I think that in the end, you know, managers can inspire a certain amount of confidence and present analytics and whatnot. But in the end, it's the players who are up at the plate with the bat and the players who are out in the field throwing the ball and catching the ball. So, you know, I think that there was, you know, the Dodgers were just overmatched by a superior team of, you know, players who hit well, players who fielded with almost near impeccability. We'll leave J.D. Martinez out of that for now. But I just think that the Dodgers really failed to perform. Granted, they ran up against an excellent, excellent baseball team that features the highest payroll in Major League Baseball. But you know, so to put it all on the manager, I think, is unfair.
All right. Well, that's Matt Pepin, sports editor for the Boston Globe. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, thanks for being here again with
great
your
to
Red
be
Sox
here.
Jersey.
Let's take the pass to the Super Bowl next.
All right. Stay with us. Coming up, one woman's journey to understand and choose race in America. I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. What happens when race is not inherited at birth, but acquired, even chosen later in life? What happens when you get race after you arrive as an immigrant to the United States? Those are questions asked by author Sharmila Sen in the beginning of her new memoir, Not Quite, Not White, Losing and Finding Race in America. She's also the executive editor at large at Harvard University Press, and she joins us now. Sharmila Sen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Maria.
Of course. So you grew up in Calcutta, India, where, as you explain in the book, race isn't one of the methods of social segmentation. In fact, it wasn't really part of the cultural dialogue the way it is in America. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about the lines which you did see your community divided by.
Of course. I grew up in India till I was 12 years old. And of course, while we didn't have race, we had lots and lots of different ways of dividing ourselves up. I think all societies do. Mm-hmm. For us at that time, of course, it was we divided up ourselves according to lines drawn around language, religion, ethnic group, caste, economic class, and even geographic region, such as North versus South India. And just as lots of societies around the world, which have devised ways of creating these lines of partitions for creating hierarchy or creating social divisions, there were also as many ways of traversing those lines, mm-hmm. right, of crossing those boundaries, mm-hmm. and then also being alert to checking who's crossing those boundaries. We had all of those ways of dividing ourselves up, but race we didn't have.
So I want to get to a passage in your book and have you read it. It's at the very beginning of your memoir. You write about a conversation you had with a friend from your English PhD program, where you ask why everyone always sort of gravitates toward the two of you at parties, and you're sort of contemplating this, and he tells you it's because you, an Indian woman, and him, a black man, smile so much more than the rest of the people around you. You ask him why you smile so much. Will you take it from there and
sure.
read the passage?
And absolutely. And if people could see us right now, actually, you and I are smiling yeah. at each other a
yeah.
lot. And
we, are.
We have these big grins. On
yeah.
our, and
yeah.
and so this is the section where I talk about the smile.
Right.
Why do we smile so much? I ask him. My cheeks hurt from smiling so much, and I cannot keep it up. We smile, he tells me, because it is the only face we can show. If we stop smiling, they will see how angry we are, and no one likes an angry black man. Or an angry brown woman, I add silently, editing our conversation. But I think you know this already, he continues, and so you smile wide and crack all those jokes. At the end of the 19th century, the African-American poet Paul Laurence Dunbar wrote, "We wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes." In the early decades of the 21st century, I know that if I stop grinning, I will frighten others with my anger. Anger is the useless emotion of people with grievances. Civilized people, superior people, capable people manage anger through reason, televised town hall meetings, logic gates, strategic planning, branding exercises, op-eds, and fireside chats with tea and sherry.
That resonates so much. I think as a country, we're having a conversation right now, a reckoning with anger, right? You hear writers like Rebecca Traister imploring Americans to listen to why people are angry, to confront anger, and to stop avoiding it. What did you wrestle with when you were writing this book and thinking about anger in a way?
I think one of the things I wrestled with was the idea that, you know, I think in many ways, and I write about this in the book, that anger has become something of a third world emotion, or that it's not a heroic emotion anymore.
Right.
You know, so I go all the way back to...
But there's something crass to, in
there's
anger,
something
right?
crass. You know, it's not heroic in the kind of epic sense
right.
that the anger of Achilles, you know, there was a time when anger of heroes and gods is what kind of gave rise to great narrative. But there's just, you know, this is why I said, you know, anger is the stuff, is the emotion of the losers or people with grievances. And by which I really mean is actually that we have words, you know, if heroic anger is gone, there, we have other words for angry brown people or angry black people or angry women, you know, that, that there are some people who can't, I think, be allowed, particularly in contemporary American society, to express their anger. Or if when they do, that the price they pay for it is much greater than the price perhaps a white man might pay for his anger.
Perhaps somebody like President Trump, who sometimes appears angry, or Brett Kavanaugh at his Supreme Court hearings when he was waiting to be confirmed, showed a lot of anger when the Senate tried to question him about the allegations
yes,
of rape.
Yes, yes. I mean, in fact, in both those examples, you see that,
of assault,
you know,
I should
it's
say.
It's a kind of anger that, you know, in the second case, there's, you know, of the Kavanaugh case, it's been, I guess, I've read about this in the media, that was also a kind of a stage-managed anger, that maybe, you know, that there was some advice that, you know, to perform that way would help him achieve his goals. And that kind of anger has worked. And I would just say, in contrast to that, so if we're looking at our present president's performance of anger, a very public performance of anger, and the way it resonates, I think, even positively with some people. If we look at the previous president, who was possibly, right. you know, the most controlled, the least angry, you know, right. and even the cadence of his speech,
right.
the measured tones, you know.
There's a professorial quality almost
yes,
about
and
it,
I
yeah.
think we, I mean, you know, we ascribe these things to their personalities, but I think that, you know, while that may be the case, it just might be that one is more measured and professorial in their speaking tone and the other is more kind of, you know, loud and angry, but I think it's also because they're also historical products of right. a particular society. So they're also, you know, doing things that society allows them to do, or doing things that they know is sort of almost encouraged by the society of which they're a product. So I look at each of them as both individuals, but I think also as kind of products of large historical moments.
Right, as we all are, right?
Right.
So when you moved to America, actually to Cambridge, you could really see the cultural divisions in the U.S. with much greater clarity. What do you remember about those very first impressions?
I think the very first impressions I remember, I when I came to Cambridge first, I started in seventh grade at the Peabody School, which was then located on Linnean Street, and which is in a fairly well-off part of Cambridge. It still is. That's a nice neighborhood. That's not where our apartment was, so I used to walk or take the school bus over there. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, I had arrived in August, and the school department assigned me to the Peabody School. I started, this is 1982, Boston had just undergone its immense desegregation program. Busing was a word that was kind of whispered around by the teachers. As a kid, I didn't quite know what it meant, but what I did know was where kids sat in the cafeteria, you know, and I was completely new to this country, new in a way. I don't think immigrants today can be new anymore, because you have to remember this is pre-internet, pre-social media. Mm-hmm. I'd never left my country, India, until I was 12 years old. So I was really seeing America through brand new eyes. And what I was watching was where do the kids sit? And I was picking up a lot about race, about socioeconomic status, about, and to a lesser extent, a little bit about religion, too.
Now, you lay out so many ways that you try to achieve, quote, total Americanization, capital T, capital A. You even constructed what you call a field guide for going native. First, will you explain what that means and then tell me what it looked like? How did you go native?
Yes. Well, total Americanization, because I think that, you know, when you're 12 and you come as a foreign kid to the public schools of America, you want to blend in really fast. It's not a pleasant thing to be the foreigner in an American public school playground. And I just threw myself into it, you know, between start of fall 1982 and Christmas. You know, I was always an overachiever, so I think this is how I thought I would do it. So I could learn, first of all, to speak this way, the way you hear me speak right now.
Right.
This
is
not how I spoke back then.
Yeah.
And so part of it was, of course, the usual stuff of any 12-year-old girl. You know, you try to figure out what the latest clothes are and how are kids supposed to dress. It was the 80s, you know, so I cut off all the waistbands and neckbands off my sweatshirts, wore them inside out. I learned to try and, you know, sort of what the popular music is. I watched a lot of television. So I came home by 3 o'clock. I was alone in our apartment. My parents were at work. And we had this tiny black and white hand-me-down TV. And I watched General Hospital and then every single rerun I could find. And I was basically trying to get an American accent. That was my first step.
Right.
Into total Americanization is to speak American.
Well, you know, we're running out of time here, but for our last question here, I want to ask you, eventually you did reach that place where you were, as you say, passing as white. But then at some point when others affirmed that for you, saying, I don't see you as white. You were really angry. So tell me about that transformation from wanting to pass to being angry when people met you there. How and why did that anger set in? We've come full circle.
Yes,
with
absolutely.
Anger.
I mean, you know, I mean, the very thing I wanted, which is to pass, to blend in. And other than my name, a lot of people on the street wouldn't know I wasn't white. But just when I thought I achieved it, you know, I mean, if not actually being seen as white, but something like a white adjacent or an honorary white, right? When that happened, I felt incredibly angry because I felt like I had given up some part of myself or others had forgotten it. I had become that kind of comfortable token minority, the sort that provided sort of diversity without a lot of discomfort. And that didn't feel right. You know, I wanted to just sort of put my face in the pillow and scream just as I achieved the very thing I thought I had wanted when I was 12 years old.
Yeah. Well, Sharmila Sen, thank you for joining us. She's the author of Not Quite, Not White, Losing and Finding Race in America.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Maria Garcia. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.